Okay, welcome back. Charlie Smith is here tonight. He's one of our great stable of monthly regulars. Comes on every, well, the third Wednesday of each month to spend the first hour of the program with us, talking about his, well, his view of the world, which is very studied, very well-informed, and is reflected as such on his brilliant website, softwar.net. If you go to softwar.net, right at the top, you'll happen to see a little black graphic which says Deception under a red star. And when you click on that, we want to congratulate Charlie. His book is out. It's called Deception. It's the true story of the greatest Chinese espionage successes against the United States ever. Deception takes the reader through a documented tale of spies, secrets, money, sex, and power that dominates the U.S. government. This book is extraordinary. You'll get the full story from the journalist that broke the ChinaGate scandal, along with the documented evidence that turned ChinaGate into a full-blown investigation. Author Charles R. Smith names the Chinese generals, the greedy corporate bosses that sold America out to China. It's all in the book, Deception. This is a big story, and of course it happened under the watch of former El Presidente, Slick Willie himself. This is a big story. Have you tabulated or come up with a guesstimate on the damages in dollars done to America by Clinton's lack of competence, shall we say? Just be charitable and just call it a lack of competence, not treason. We'll start out with lack of competence. How much did it cost us, Charlie?
Probably on the order of somewhere between $400 to $500 billion.
Half a trillion, easy.
Yes. Somewhere around there. That's about how much it cost us to develop most of this technology and sold it for essentially pennies on the dollar to the Chinese, who were able to literally leap forward from 1950s and early 1960s technology to Generation 3 mobile ballistic missiles, you know, state-of-the-art stuff.
That's about a 40-year leap at American taxpayer expense under the watch of President and Mrs. Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, you certainly won't find the book at the Clinton Library.
No.
I have offered an autographed copy, but have gotten no response from them.
Really?
Yeah.
How rude.
I figured they'd probably put it in the double wide out back, but, you know.
No, the single round in the back of the office.
Yeah, something along that line. So it is interesting, though, from my own point of view, because I have a copy of My Life and Living History, and a real good example is you don't see a single mention of Mokhtar Riady, James Riady, or John Huang at all in either of the Clinton books. They're not listed. They're not mentioned. Obviously, it wasn't part of his life or their living history, which is extraordinary considering the number of years and the amount of money that flowed and the numerous meetings and efforts that went between the three.
Numerous.
Yeah, I dedicate an entire chapter to John Huang, his connections with Lippo Group, and his work at the Commerce Department.
How did you do all the research, Charlie? Was it real hard, or did you get lucky on the internet and have your usual excellent sources to back, or did you get some real bonanzas here and there?
Well, this was, you know, years of intense work with the Freedom of Information Act, suing the federal government in some cases, forcing them to release this information. That's one of the reasons why, you know, despite the fact that I put all this down in writing, mm-hmm. make some rather terrible accusations. It's all documented.
Right.
Since we're all backed up by real documents signed by real people, the corporations and the individuals in question certainly don't want to go to court because it would look awfully bad.
To put it mildly, it's not incompetence, is it?
Oh, this was absolute deliberate.
Yeah.
There was no... it was very competent from the point of view that the operations that were undertaken were deliberately invoked to deceive the American public into believing they were dealing with benevolent civilian organizations in China and the reality of the situation was that these were Chinese military officers representing military design bureaus who were in business for military technology.
Mm-hmm. Well, the People's Liberation Army really is, to a large degree, China's corporate structure, corporate world. Their whole corporate ethos is basically predicated on a bedrock of People's Liberation Army companies. They've got over 5,000 or 6,000 of them around the world operating. I mean, you deal with China, you're dealing with a PLA at some level.
Yeah, there is PLA Inc., and I think I have an entire chapter describing that interrelationship between the Chinese defense industry, the Chinese military. Obviously, you know, the first thing you have to understand, there's no conflict of interest laws in China, so you can be a Chinese general
right.
and the head of a major corporation at the same time.
Not a problem at all, right.
Absolutely no difficulty there. Now, the other thing that you have to understand, and this is something that where we run into trouble with the Chinese, is that many of the defense ministers who we will negotiate with, like on arms deals, arms limitations, or restrictions on exports, are also the CEOs of the same companies that sell this equipment, so they have a vested interest
mm-hmm.
right off the bat to break whatever diplomatic agreements they make.
In Deception, we cover, I'm sure, I haven't gotten the book yet, all the highlights, lowlights, excuse me, of the greatest sellout under, I think, any administration that we've been able to determine yet and study openly like this one. This was so blatant and so in our faces, even though it was somewhat covered up, at least at the time. But when you look at the bigger picture, I mean, like the Loral satellite launch, I mean, that's just one small example. The shipment of how many state-of-the-art mega computers from IBM to China for peaceful purposes, of course. I mean, it just went on and on and on. And these were the actual tools that allowed the Chinese and the brilliant strategists, manipulators, scientists in their own right, to jump decades ahead over a few short years.
Well, you know, one of the areas where I'm pointing out for the deceiving portion, for example, you mentioned the export of supercomputers. Many of the companies and corporations that we exported to were essentially front companies.
Right. Oldest trick in the book, yeah.
Right. Now, we have the other aspect of this was Chinese Air Force officers coming to the United States, visiting some of our most sophisticated facilities, places like Edwards Air Force Base, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But they were coming over listed as civilians. Literally, the federal government, our government, accepted their credentials as civilians, as part of the civilian aviation industry, and allowed these people to come in. One document just jumps right out. The FAA personnel that were meeting with these Chinese Army Air Force officers had the official documentation listed each one of these officers as a commissioner of the Chinese Civil Aviation.
Mm-hmm.
In handwritten notes all right next to each name, the FAA official wrote their true rank. And one example is General Ku Fu Lin. Doesn't sound like a very sophisticated person right off the bat, but here's the kick. Ku Fu Lin was the operations officer in charge of the planning for Tiananmen Square. This is the guy that put together the plan to send in the tanks, to send in the special forces units to take out the demonstrators. He was banned.
To liquidate the demonstrators as much as he could.
He was essentially banned from traveling to the United States.
Right. Ku Fu Lin. His real name is, his first name is No, of course. No Fu Lin.
Well, in essence, General Ku was banned from traveling to the United States because of his participation in the Tiananmen Square massacre.
Right.
Yet he was able to come over as a commissioner in their Civil Aviation Bureau.
Not a problem, once again. Now, the Clinton administration is not stupid. They knew what was going on. They sold out for the money. Who got the money?
Oh, well, a litany of corporations, Loral, Hughes, Boeing, Motorola,
All the companies that had done the years and years of work, the years and years of R&D, just basically dished it off?
Essentially, this is true. Most of the equipment, technology, years of research, a litany of advanced military technology, radiation-hardened computer chips, which are obviously critical for use in thermonuclear warfare as well as for use in nuclear warheads.
And we just served it right up to them on a silver platter. Back in just a minute with Charlie Smith. His new book, Deception, is out. Click on his name. Go to softwar.net. It's right there. This is an incredible story. Okay, talking with Charlie Smith about his extraordinarily important new book, Deception. The Loral missile launch, which didn't work, and the warhead, the satellite came back down, crashed, but it wasn't thoroughly destroyed. And the problem was when the Loral technicians apparently went to recover the satellite to check it out, maybe save it, I don't know. They found out that many of the key ultra-top-secret components had already been stripped out of it before it was placed into the launch vehicle, which in this particular case failed at liftoff. Am I missing much, or is that the gist of that particular story?
You pretty much hit that one right on the head.
So, folks, listen. We have this incredibly important American ultra-secret technology, which we don't want to give the Chinese. And yet we sign a contract with them to let them launch a satellite made by Loral, which contains these absolutely priceless technological advances. The launch vehicle, whoops, didn't work. Bang, it comes down. It didn't get very high. The satellite survives. The Loral techs who are on site to monitor the launch pick it up, look at the inside of the thing to check it out, and find out that this ultra-secret software, hardware, computer chips, whatever, already pulled out of the satellite, which wouldn't have functioned even if it had gotten into orbit, apparently. That's incredible, and that's just one example that you cover in the book.
Well, yeah, there's another example.
How stupid are we? How stupid are the Loral technicians to allow the Chinese... to have allowed the Chinese to get near enough to this satellite, which you know how they wrap these things up in ultra-sterile this and that, and get in there and pull these... Or did somebody within the Loral Corporation pull these pieces out in advance as part of a deal? Were they bribed? What's going on?
Well, if you look at it from the external point of view, the Loral Corporation, led by Bernard Schwartz, wanted to do many different deals with the Chinese military, and they lobbied rather heavily to sell military-level technology to the Chinese. The reason why I know that is I got some of the documents that he presented to Ron Brown in a briefing on what they would like to export to China. At that time, Loral was a fairly large defense organization. They sold most of those pieces off, like the Lockheed. And one reason why we know they wanted to sell defense technology was because of a wonderful letter written by a man by, I believe, the name of Linfeld, who was running Loral Defense. That was the exact name of their segment in Arizona. Supporting the sale of synthetic aperture radar systems to the Chinese.
And
he even attached a letter from the Beijing Institute for Remote Sensing. That sounds so benevolent. The Institute for Remote Sensing, kind of like the White House for the blind. They wanted this synthetic radar so they could do things like monitor floods, and they needed it very badly.
Of course.
Because it was just so terrible when it rains over there. Well, the real kick to this is Linfeld made it very clear the Defense Department opposed the sale and had even turned them down. And he appealed to Ron Brown through his chairman of Loral, Bernard Schwartz, to find someone high enough in the Clinton administration to override the Defense Department.
Hmm.
Even the State Department said no. And again, it was in his letter. And I include all of this in detail. Now, the fun part about it is the Beijing Institute for Remote Sensing is actually the Chinese Army Design Bureau for radar and electro-optical guidance systems for missiles.
And as if we didn't know.
You can tell exactly what they were intending on using
of course.
This radar for. Well, the radar system itself, after we gave it to them, ended up on a couple of aircraft that they are currently using to surveil Japan, Korea, the Philippines, and Taiwan, as well as our own guys as far away as Guam. They fly over international waters. It is a look-down type of radar for monitoring things on the ground. Well, it even gets worse, and this is where we add in insult to injury. One of the Chinese airlines that has taken possession of American-built airliners from Boeing, China United, flies a civilian airliner equipped with this synthetic radar system. It's got a 40-foot radar dome on the bottom. It has never flown a single commercial mile. It is strictly run and operated by the Chinese Air Force for surveillance purposes, yet it flies in the China United airline livery with colors. I believe it is B4373, official international number. This essentially is a real live spy plane. Of course, you know, you and I both have a little understanding of how an airline or why would an airline fly an airplane equipped with a 40-foot radar dome on the bottom and control and equipment and, of course, Army personnel inside.
Just extra baggage compartment is all it is.
China United is owned and operated by the Chinese Air Force.
Amazing. Just another small tidbit of how we were thoroughly raped and sold out by the Clinton administration for years, allowing China to make up decades in technology. Okay, we're back with Charlie Smith, and do pick up his book if you care at all about this world of ours, and the fact, the simple fact, the tragic fact that the Clinton administration and other unnamed administrations have done this kind of thing for too long. But under the Clintons, it was just like a shopping bazaar for the People's Liberation Army and the China Air Force and anybody else over there who was playing this great game of penetrate the United States, sap its vitality, and win the war without even having to shoot anything. The book is Deception, How Clinton Sold America, how about, how the Clintons sold America to the Chinese Army. You can get the book right at software.net by clicking on the book itself, the link underneath. So by all means, do that. All right, Charlie, let's take a look at the obvious here. Pretty grim over there. I don't see any light at the end of the tunnel. I see nearly 30 million people who are getting more and more angry every day. It's not looking good. How do you see it? It's a big story.
Well, actually, this was fairly predictable from the point of view that the election over here is over, and therefore the Bush administration has given the green light to our military to perform basically unlimited ground operations. As you well knew, right, going up to the election, there was an extreme amount of political pressure placed in the administration not to bring casualties, not to cause casualties. Obviously, Fallujah being one spot where they just kind of stood around and watched. Now we have, you know, the Marines and your Iraqi Army Guard units moving through Fallujah.
But, you know, let me interrupt here. They're moving through Fallujah, but do they really control it? You know how that game goes in an urban warfare setting. If you're on any given street corner, you may claim control while you're there, but when you drive away, who's got control? So control is a very interesting word as it's used in these kinds of situations. Whether it's the Soviets in Afghanistan or the Americans in Fallujah, doesn't matter. It's the same thing.
Once again, the in a guerrilla-style warfare, obviously the objective of the guerrilla units is not to confront our armed forces directly, but to essentially indirectly work or move in close, and therefore not allowing us to bring our extreme firepower to bear. Actually, like I said, this was not unanticipated, and frankly, if you look at the total number of incidents being portrayed in the news, we're getting down to, okay, the bad guys blew up a car in one of the cities. Whoop-dee-doo. Okay, we had more violence in some cases down in Argentina, where some of the local leftists decided to blow up bombs inside of a couple of banks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other aspect, and this is something that I think is beginning to backfire their killing of Hassan.
Okay. Now, first of all, one thing. In Argentina, 100,000 Argentinians haven't died. Their collateral damage, whatever you want to call it, but that's a pretty good projection. That's a tragedy. That always happens in these kinds of wars.
You can guarantee that if there had been a bomb in any bank in the major Iraqi cities, it would have been on the nightly news here.
Right. All right. Margaret Hassan.
Right.
Hassan.
That's a backfire. That's something that they should not have done.
If they did it. We don't know who those people are. They're hooded. We honestly don't know who they are. We don't know. We're told who they are. We can see the pictures of them. Those people are such and such. We don't know who they are. They could be mercenaries.
Again,
they could be.
Keep in mind, one of the biggest ongoing scams in Iraq has been the kidnap for money routine.
Well, they didn't get much for her.
Well, obviously.
But again, you got to ask who benefits. Who benefits the most? Why would the so-called resistance kill one of the great Caucasian friends of that civilization, the great Western people?
Once again, it fits in with al-Zarqawi and with his operations to provide terror against any Westerners and Western forces, as well as any assistance being provided by the outside.
Well, my point is, Charlie, how do we know when we admittedly have tens of thousands of paid mercenaries of all different stripes there carrying out all kinds of operations for their paymasters? How do we know who the hell did it, for sure?
My point being is that it really doesn't matter. It is very apparent what it was done for. There was a money demand beforehand. This is one of many different operations which are undertaken in the same fashion by these opposition forces, and it is essentially backfiring across the board. Even people who are anti-American in Iraq are essentially against this kind of violence.
Well, of course they are,
and they should be. They're actually beginning to show their revulsion by saying we shouldn't even be doing any of this. The fastest way to get us out of there, for one thing, is to stop the violence and have their own guard units take over. They know that, and that's essentially one of the things that we are beginning to see. Again, when we start talking about operations outside of Tikrit, which is, you know, one of the hometowns of Saddam and his family, and Mosul, which is even north of there, you know, what is happening is major military operations are being put into play by our forces in an attempt to essentially wipe out the logistics and cause a great deal of casualties on these foreign fighters and mercenaries. And what we're beginning to find, obviously, is the word circulating around is that Syria is at least tacitly approving the export of many of these terrorists across their own border into Iraq.
We should also note, when I say mercenaries, I'm not strictly talking about mercenaries hired by the so-called resistance. I'm talking about mercenaries hired on our side of the ledger. There are all kinds of mercenaries there.
Well, we've had that same situation in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in Uzbekistan. The Middle East, in some cases, is a wild, wild west. It's not exactly a nice place to be,
and
I can guarantee that there are a lot of people that are not very nice at all, and it wouldn't matter whether you're local or not. They still apply the same kind of violence and essentially thuggery type of tactics to run the local regimes. And we've seen this before, and it's not like it's unusual. We have to ask yourself, the obvious logical question with Japan and Germany, how many of our troops had to stay after for occupation? Frankly, every time I hear somebody say, bring the troops home, I look at them and say, yeah, I think our troops have finally pacified Germany. Maybe they should come home.
Right. All right. Well, pause and be right back with Charlie Smith. Okay, we are back with Charlie Smith, and do go to his website and pick up his indispensable book, Deception, explaining the whole thing under the most tawdry, sellout administration you could imagine. Well, one of them anyway. Deception, it's there at software.net. Now, I ran a story written by Mark Gaffney, you've seen it, about the Sunburn missile and how it impacts traditional naval task forces, nuclear-powered aircraft carriers being the queen bee of a task force. The Yukonts, the successor missile to the Sunburn, is even more devastating, 2.3 Mach, I guess, and can just dance circles around the Sunburn in terms of penetrating the whole issue. As a defensive military strategy, what are you going to do to stop those two missiles?
The number one strategy that's being executed to deal with these systems is to essentially place a vessel in harm's way. The objective of the Sovremnyi-class destroyers that are armed with the Sunburn are essentially a throwaway. Okay, their idea is to try to stay as close as possible to the carrier or her battle group. So if in time of conflict, they are able to get off that salvo of missiles first. The obvious point being that they are able to, therefore, unleash their firepower, and they will probably be sunk immediately afterwards. Well, our guys are used to that. We had to play that very same tactic with the Kreska-class battle cruisers from the Soviet days. And essentially what you do is you assign an escort to the sub-remnies, whether it's above the surface or below the surface is of no matter. And if you believe that they are turning to fire, that escort is there to sink them instantly.
And if it doesn't?
Then defending against the missiles are going to be somewhat difficult.
Somewhat, yeah. You lose a carrier pretty easily if you don't. The Indians have modified the sunburn, as Mr. Gaffney.
The Indians are actually using what's called the the PM-80, which is a revised version of the SSN-26 Yahant.
Yeah, well, that thing goes apparently toward the target, up 50,000 feet and straight down hypersonically on the target or something like that. I mean, that's
yeah, that's actually a designated pop-up maneuver, which actually is a disadvantage against our warships because the Aegis missile system can intercept them in that circumstance. It's the sea skimming program version of the Yahant as well as the Sunburn that can be much more devastating coming in at somewhere around 9 to 12 feet off the water.
9 to 12 feet.
It is much more difficult to detect. You know, your time from horizon 15 miles away to impact at the speeds these things are traveling is less around 20 seconds. So you have to be able to respond rapidly. And the way to deal with both the Yahant as well as the Sunburn in flight, as we have seen, is the new EH version of the F-18 Hornets have the specialized look-down, shoot-down radar systems. They're just now being introduced. This is a highly accurate scanning radar system designed to actually scan right down to that surface level. It is designed specifically to find cruise missiles.
You have made good points, and the issue of the Persian Gulf is another one, because the launching of a Sunburn or a Yukons would be over land in many cases. So you've got far less water to traverse. It's a different ballgame. You've got a battle group in a closed fishbowl, basically, and things get real hot and heavy real fast.
Yeah, you know, if we're talking about inside the Gulf waters, you have a limited amount of space. Your defenses are compressed. The flip side of that is that when you're talking about a battle group, you also have a considerable amount of air power flying along with you and communicating with your Aegis systems to deal with both. Now, there are some disadvantages to Yahant as well as Sunburn, and this was essentially documented in my chapter on the Sunburn. One of the things that we discovered dealing with the Russians was that they utilized designs and, in some cases, equipment that they bought from foreign suppliers as integrated components. The radar altimeter, for example, of the Sunburn is actually a German design and even German-supplied piece of equipment. If you are able to fool that radar altimeter with an electronic signal into thinking that it is either too high or too low, it will cause the missile to overcorrect. If it thinks that it is too high, it'll dive into the water. If it's too low, it'll pull up and become a much more viable target for our missile defenses. As the Brits found, and as we have found examining both Yahant's as well as the Sunburn's radar tracking systems, the Brits found during the Falklands War that chaff was an extremely valuable component of your defenses. You didn't even have to shoot at these things to essentially eliminate their operational capability, and chaff being one way of faking a missile warhead into thinking that it's chasing a warship. In reality, it's doing nothing but chasing a large cloud of aluminum foil. So the countermeasures that we do have in place, some of which I'm not really at liberty to talk about, do have the capability of foiling these missiles. But where we get into the real sticky wicket is the nuclear-tipped versions of the Sunburn. You know, you're looking at a 100-kiloton warhead, maybe a 200-kiloton warhead at maximum. Definitely nasty very, very nasty. Even a near miss is going to be able to take out a good portion of a battle group. And in the case of Yahant, unlike the Sunburn, the Yahant is a canister-driven system, meaning that it can be mounted on a variety of warships or even on land installations. The Sunburn, we found, essentially because of its sea-skimming capability, if you launch it from a platform where it has to dive at more than a 15-degree angle to reach the shoreline or the sea-skimming mode, okay, it'll literally dive into the water because it doesn't have the aerodynamics to correct itself quickly enough. There are direct limitations that the Sunburn has. It's one of the reasons why when you see the Sunburn launchers on the Sovremenny class ships, they're angled slightly upward.
Uh-huh.
Okay. There are some very critical components in their launch and the use and tactics. The Yahant, on the other hand, could be launched even from a submarine. That makes it extremely dangerous from the point of view that one could pop up out of the water relatively close by, and you'd have almost no time and no chance to intercept it.
Right. Big problems for the Navy.
Well, what we found, the Zhuhai air show just ended in China, and one of the areas that is a major point of the Chinese military industries that they were trying to make is that they're working very feverishly on their own cruise missiles. And it appears the guys at Reduja, which is the manufacturer of the Sunburn, as well as the Machinery Design Bureau, the guys who make the Yahant,
right,
have contracts with the Chinese to help them manufacture their own indigenous cruise missiles. So we will be seeing the Chinese fielding both a new series of anti-ship missiles as well as land attack cruise missiles designed to attack land targets, and that will be coming over the next 2 to 3 years.
Coming soon to a military theater near you.
You'll see them first in the Taiwan Straits.
Yeah. Okay, we've got a couple minutes left. What's our car collector doing up there in Pyongyang?
That one is a real wild one. This past week, we've gotten reports, very credible reports, coming out of Moscow, out of Beijing, that in the embassies, the North Korean embassies, as well as in Pyongyang itself, pictures of Kim Jong-il have been removed.
And replaced with nothing.
Apparently is some pattern to this.
Hmm.
Because the pictures of Kim Sung, the father of the North Korean state, have remained.
Uh-huh.
Whereas the son, the current ruler, Kim Jong, has been removed from the embassies, has been removed. There were a couple of receptions that were held in Beijing at the North Korean embassy, and they found that the pictures of Kim Jong-il had been removed. We're not quite sure what this means.
I'm not either. Maybe we'll see if they replace them with something else. I don't know.
Well, obviously in a totalitarian regime, when your illustrious leader's pictures have been removed, that generally does not bode well for the leader. There's some change in power taking place. This is one of those really weird things that North Korea watchers are just sitting on pins and needles trying to figure out what's going on inside North Korea. Has there been a coup? We haven't seen Kim Jong in a couple of weeks. He hasn't made any speeches or announcements. There is no official word being given out by any of the ambassadors or any of the official diplomats.
Well, we'll see. Maybe in the next 3 or 4 weeks, when you come back next time, we'll have a better handle on it, the mystery of the disappearing pictures. Thanks, Charlie. Always fascinating. And congratulations on the book. I urge all of you to go and get a copy of it. Deception at softwar.net. Take care.
Thank you.
Okay, good night. All right, back in just a couple minutes as we take our top of the hour break and return.